Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills.
Negotiation Ninja listeners, welcome to this amazing throwback edition of the Negotiations Ninja podcast with guest Chris Hadnagy, also known as the Chief Human Hacker. In this episode, Chris shares the framework he created to improve your social experiences, improve your communication, and how to win friends, influence people, and leave them better off for having met you. If you're striving to use your influence for the good of others, this is a can't-miss episode.
Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm excited, man. I'm really excited to have you on. I'm really excited to talk about this amazing new book. Having read a lot of your work before on social engineering and how we can have those deeper level conversations, and especially with how it relates to sort of negotiation and infosec sort of sectors, I think it's really, really cool that you took all of that experience and now you're rolling it into basically how people can better communicate with each other.
Thank you.
But before we get too deep into that, maybe you could give the listeners a bit of background as to who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I started off my career in this field, at least as a pen tester, or what we call an adversarial simulator. So I get to do these really amazing things like get paid to hack companies and break into places. And going back about 15 years, maybe 14 years, I decided to write a framework on social engineering, which was something that hadn't been done before. So what that meant is looking at books that I had on my shelf about psychology, nonverbal communications, influence, and figuring out how those apply to what I was doing every day for my job. That framework came out around 2008-09. And it was very shortly after that Kevin Mitnick's publisher, he's a very famous social engineer who got arrested for social engineering, the FBI and a bunch of telephone companies. His publisher called me and asked me to write a book, which was my very first book, Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. I didn't want to write that book, but I did it anyway. And that book launched this company that I have now because people were calling and saying, can you consult us on this and do this? So I started doing that as a job, which was a really interesting thing because at the time, again, nobody was doing it as a full career. So we kind of created this as an industry, you know, and now we're jumping forward 12 years and I got 5 books on it. But, you know, to answer your question directly, over that period of time, what I saw was that people were coming to my classes that had nothing to do with InfoSec. They weren't in this industry. They were salespeople. They were psychologists, teachers, negotiators, stay-at-home parents. And I was always saying, like, why are you here? Why are you in this class? And they would be like, well, my buddy who's in InfoSec took this class and said, I needed to be in this because it was going to change my life. And that happened so many times that I said, I need to write a book. So the nature of this book came from that concept, was that there was people not in my industry that were benefiting from this knowledge. And I said, could we really write a book about how I've hacked all these companies through my career and using those communication skills could be better? So the first part of my mission was, can I do it myself? So I started to use these skills in everyday life to see, can I do this and leave people feeling better and not be a bad guy? And when I saw it work, then this book idea came out of the air and I can't believe we found an agent to take it. And then that agent sold it to HarperCollins. And here we are sitting here with a major book release on this topic.
Amazing, man. It's a very exciting time. And I find that especially in today's day and age, you know, where we feel like this increasing sense of powerlessness, right? Yeah. There's people are more and more insecure, maybe apprehensive when they're communicating with each other. It's needed. It's really needed in today's day and age. Maybe I'll start the conversation there. Why do you suppose there is this sort of increasing feeling of apprehensiveness around communication and talking to each other?
Yeah. So let's talk. I'm going to give you like a hierarchy in this because this really was a major thought for me when I was writing this book. And I'm going to start pre-COVID. We're in a time in human history where we communicate more using a digital presence. The internet also has given people this empowerment that they wouldn't have. There's things that people may say to you or to me over the internet that they would never say to your face, right? I mean, right. I had this wonderful privilege of giving a TEDx talk, and I got a guy in the comments of that TEDx talk telling me how I'm a fat slob, right? Now, I can guarantee you, if I met this guy in person, he would never walk up to me and say that to my face,
Yeah.
Because we're just not that kind of people. We're not rude like that in normal. Like, we don't want to be that awkward in front of somebody. But on the internet, this guy's empowered. Now, I didn't say anything. I had someone come to my defense, like, hey, man, that's rude. And he's like, this dude needs to lay off cheeseburgers. Now, he felt empowered to argue his point because of the internet. Now, this is what's happened, right? People who maybe feel a little misogynistic, a little racist, a little homophobic, they feel empowered on the internet to say whatever it is that they want on the internet, because that anonymity has made them not worry about the consequences. You're not here to beat me up, so I can insult you, and it doesn't matter because we're thousands of miles apart. So who cares? And that thought process has made our interactions and the way we communicate very self-centered. Now we take this to the COVID time, right? So last year kicks in, and in this country, in America, we're quarantined. We're not traveling as much. We're working on the internet. We're schooling on the internet. We're entertaining on the internet. We have lost this ability for compassionate, empathetic, in-person communications. So what I've noticed overall is that we have lost this ability to look at another person and communicate with me thinking about you and what you want out of this conversation, as opposed to me being so self-centered. So it's needed today because of the situation we're in human nature. You know, and I refer to, and it's kind of like an allude to it in the name of the book, the How to Win Friends and Influence People. Like, that book is pivotal for many of us. It was written in 1936, right? So when I thought about this, what can we take the lessons from a book that pivotal to bring to 2021? How can we use it today? What do we need today that wasn't available in 1936? And really, that's why I felt that this was something that was just so needed right now.
I love that you add to that, right? So how to win friends, influence people, and then leave them better off having met you. And I think that for me is sort of the pivotal part of the title, because I think so often, especially in sort of the industry that I come from, in the negotiation world, sales world, oftentimes it's sort of like a me kind of a discussion, right? What can I get out of this? What can I achieve from this? What am I going to take out of this? And it's not beneficial towards creating additional value when you have that kind of mindset, because all that kind of mindset does when you approach the conversation, it's an extraction mindset, not a value provision mindset. Talk to me about, you said, what are the things that, when Dale Carnegie wrote that book, what are some of the things that sort of help frame his mind? But then all of this stuff happened in the interim, and now we need some additional tools. What are those additional tools?
So because we live in a digital age, right, we need to learn how to apply these over a space that is not always in person. How can I use these skills on Twitter? How can I use them when right now you and I are having a video conversation, but I can only see from mid-chest up?
Right.
I can't see where your hips are. I can't see your hands, right? Yeah. But that part of your body would tell me so much if we were in person.
Right.
Right. Your hips would tell me where, if you're interested in me, your hands would tell me so much about if you're feeling nervous or not. I have to now learn to communicate with you without having all of the feedback that I would have if you and I were sitting in the same physical space. So the things that didn't exist in 1936 was the internet. There wasn't chats like this that Dale had to worry about when he was writing that book. So the things that we need to worry about is this. Plus, if we take it, what's happened in the media, I was just having a chat with someone yesterday. You know, yesterday was the anniversary of when the Challenger took off and blew up and all those people died. And I remember, because I'm dating myself, but I was in school. I remember being in school, and when that happened, they paused schools and they made everyone have a moment of silence for the people who lost, and they played part of that over and over. But it was so shocking that when the Challenger blew up, they took that off the TV. They didn't want kids to see it. Now, if you turn the news on and there was a school shooting or something, you're seeing dead bodies. You're seeing people with bullet holes.
Potentially even live footage.
That's right. Live footage of people being murdered.
Right.
And they may blur it out, but you're seeing it happen. The way that our brains take input in today is different. And regardless of what anybody wants to say, it calluses us. It does. It makes us different. Think about the first time you ever heard about a school shooting on the news. I don't know how it interacted with you, but I felt sick to my stomach.
Yeah,
I literally felt like nauseated. Now, when you hear it, you go, wow, that's terrible. And then you go back with your day. And it's not because we don't care. It's because we hear them so much, we've become calloused. And that is why this is needed, is because we need to be reminded that on the other end of this interaction is a person. And I don't know what you've been through, Mark. I don't know. Maybe you've had family that were affected by that. So if I'm sitting here talking about this flippantly, like it doesn't matter, And in your mind, you're going, oh my gosh, my family suffered from this. It's going to affect the way we interact. You're going to look at me like a complete jerk. So I need to be aware of what's happening in the world and how it may have affected another human being that I'm interacting with, and not be so callous and self-centered. And that the way media feeds us, the way social media feeds us, it creates a bubble around our belief systems that doesn't allow us really to expand like we used to. So there is such a difference in 1936 to today that we really need to understand how to communicate in this day and age.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think the lack of empathy even that I feel when I hear some tragic news is just like, oh, it's just another event, right? Because we hear it so often over and over and over again. Yeah, I can definitely see how you would do that. Now, you went on a mission to try and apply all of the lessons that you basically put into this book. I want to talk about that mission, because part of this process for you was to establish whether or not it could be done. And so you tested it on yourself. What was the first thing that you did to try and do that?
So, you know, what's funny is when I was teaching my class, we have homework that we give to the students. And Robin Dreek, who is the ex-director of the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, he was helping me with the homework assignments, creating them. And I was all excited about them. And he said, no, hang on. Before you give these to any of your students, you have to try each one yourself. You need at least one story. And I was like, I don't want to do this. This is for them. And they're like, then you can't give them out. And it was such a great lesson, because when I went out and did it, I found the pitfalls that the students may have. I found the success stories that I can share. I had fail stories where I could share them and say, this is where I messed up. And that became one of the best training tools for my class. So when I started writing this book, I said, okay, I need to try this. And one of the times it came about is a story I tell in the book about getting a free upgrade to flights. And it was a really important moment for me, because we were in Heathrow, my wife, my daughter, and I. We had a really long trip, and we were in economy on Virgin Airlines, which is great for economy. Virgin's a great airline. But I was like, let's just see if we can get an upgrade. And I wasn't planning on using really any manipulative tactic. I was planning on trying to just be kind. Here's how it rolled out. I'm rolling in this cart full of luggage, and I hit this bump. Not on purpose. All my luggage spills. Everybody turns around. My wife's embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. I'm one of those guys, I'm going to make a joke so that way the embarrassment dissipates. So I yell, dumb American, hit a bump on the M5, which is a road in the UK, right? Everybody laughs. Well, I noticed that one woman behind the Virgin counter was looking at me directly and laughing. And I'm like, she's in a good mood. Let's go to her. So I say it to my wife. I'm like, let's go to her. She's in a great mood. So we go over to her. Now, as soon as we get up to the counter, unplanned, and my wife is just this kind of person. She's looking at her and saying, oh my God, your makeup is so perfect. You did such a beautiful job. Like, that scarf matches. And this woman is smiling so big. Like, literally, you could see oxytocin like dripping out of her ears, right? It was like, it was just so wonderful. And I'm watching this interaction between my wife and this woman. And now my brain goes back into SE mode, social engineer mode. Now I have a choice. I know that using every skill that I have in my work, I can get a free upgrade. But I said, oh, wait, I want to see if I can do it and leave them feeling better. Now, how do you leave someone feeling better? Is you give them an option. So I needed to know that she had the freedom to say no to us. So I'm quickly, like, this is happening all in the time, in the moment. I'm processing this and I'm like, how do I give her an option? So I wait for a couple minutes of my wife complimenting her, and she's checking us in, and I'm putting bags on the thing. And I lean in, I put my arm around my wife, and I say, excuse me, you know, we probably can't afford it, but we've all had a really long trip and we're really tired. So I'm just going to ask, what would it cost for me to upgrade us three to first class? And I said, that's probably too much, maybe even business or economy plus. And she doesn't even look at me. She looks right at my wife and she starts typing. And then she leans into my wife and she goes, look, I'm going to give you all a present. First class tickets just for you guys. And I go, what? That's amazing. How much? Just tell me before you do it. Again, not even looking at me. She looks at my wife. She goes, it's free. Now we're thanking her and we're telling her how amazing this is. My wife is like, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. And I'm processing what happened. My wife is like sitting there going, this is amazing. Like, how do we do this? And I'm like, I'm processing what happened. She had an option. See, by saying, I probably can't afford it, if she didn't want to give us that, then she could have said, oh, these are $11,000 tickets. I'm like, oof, we can't afford that. Sorry. But by giving her the option, she was able to decide, does she want? If I didn't give her an option, here what would happen. She would have said, I have two choices. I can either say, okay, I'll do it, and it would have felt forced, or I have to tell this brand new best friend I have that just spent 5 minutes complimenting me, sorry, no. And that would have felt bad. So I wouldn't have left her feeling better for having met me. By giving her this option, I'm allowing her to say no to me. But if she gifts me, I'm allowing her to also feel really good about gifting me. So after that, I wrote it all down. I planned it out. I said to my wife, let's do this again. We did it six more times and it worked 4 out of 6 times.
Whoa, that's a success rate, man.
Success rate. So I said, okay, we have an 80% close ratio on this. This is great. And the other times it didn't work, I realized why. I realized why it didn't work. I was like, we went up to the counter and my wife's a pivotal part of this. She couldn't find something to honestly compliment the person about. So she talked about generic things like the day. And it wasn't because the person was me. Maybe they just were really in a bad mood. They didn't have great makeup on. And my wife, and the part of this process, which has to happen, is honesty. So I never asked my wife to lie. I never said, hey, just make something up. She had to find something to honestly compliment them about. And if she couldn't, then it was okay to say, hey, you know what? We'll talk about the weather. We'll talk about the day. We'll talk about the airline. But if none of that made the oxytocin flow, then there was no motivation to give us an upgrade. So people would go, yeah, you can upgrade. It's like $3,000 a person. I'd be like, ooh, yeah, we can't afford that. And we never broke pretext. That's the other important point. So we never, after they didn't benefit us, we didn't go, jerk, you know, we kept to it like, thanks so much for trying. You know, that's too much for us. It's a little rich for our blood. So we'll just sit back with the goats, but it's okay. And make a joke out of it. See if that worked. And those 2 times it didn't. So we ended up taking our flight happily, the one we had planned, and analyzing why it didn't work and going, okay, move on. A great lesson.
Fascinating. Do you think the sort of the self-deprecating humor that you had at the beginning when you had the accident with the luggage played into that? Did you repeat that step?
So I didn't repeat that step. That's interesting. I did a couple times, but the thing is, I never wanted to stage it. Now, So we tried it 6 more times in different airlines, and most of them were in America. So I couldn't have had that plan, right? So one other time that it did work is I actually was wheeling a cart around and I hit the turnstile thing and the little, you know, those elastic bands that keep you like in line. Yep. It came out and it like snapped like a belt. And this woman jumped and I'm like, I am such an oaf. I am so sorry. And she just laughed and the woman behind the counter laughed. And I was like, okay, the humor thing does work. Self-deprecation works because oftentimes people, when something embarrassing happens, they want to blame someone else or draw attention away from themselves. And when you don't, you say, I'm a good guy. I'm a decent person. Like, I'm okay. As long as the self-deprecation isn't too much. If at that moment I went, I'm the worst human on earth. I'm always ruining people's lives. You know, I am terrible. I'm a fat slob. Then people would have been like, this guy's messed up. Like, holy crap, back up. So the self-deprecation has to be in the balance. Right. But when you do it right and you move on and people laugh, then you can make people feel disarmed with you.
Yeah, I really like that. Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started. And you will see there 3 different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. One of the biggest concerns I think that a lot of people have in today's day and age is that because they're uncomfortable with conversation, they have this apprehension, and then they all of a sudden see someone that's really, really comfortable with conversation, really good with verbal cues and vocal cues, body language cues. They almost feel sort of at odds with that and maybe in a weaker position, and they're afraid that they might get manipulated in those kinds of situations. Yeah. How do we not only potentially get over that, but also deal with that kind of a situation if it pops up?
So for me, like, it was one of those things when I learned the skills, right? When I learned these skills of how to do this, it was a constant battle for me to remind myself to not be manipulative. So I felt it was on me, right? Because when you first learn them, it almost feels like a superpower. You kind of feel like a little bit of a superhero, right? Like looking across the room and seeing somebody and going, I know what you're feeling, and not calling them out, right? Not going, hey, you're feeling sad right now, you know, and you're not doing that. And then people go, wait, I thought I was kind of hiding that well. It's almost like non-verbally pantsing someone, you know, like calling out their emotions.
Right.
And I found by making mistakes, that really was the wrong route of going. So what I tell my students and what I tell myself is that motto of leave them feeling better applies also to this, is that think about how you would want to be treated in that situation. And then what you can do. So let's say I did notice you were sad. Instead of calling you out, I can alter something about myself, maybe to make you feel better. So maybe I lower my pitch. I slow down a little bit. And I'm like, Mark, it's just so great to be here with you today. You know, people are having a rough time right now with COVID. I don't know what you're going through, but man, you know, I know my last couple of weeks have been really hard. And I don't have to tell you I see sadness, but by doing some of those nonverbal cues, I may make you feel rapport with me. And now we're communicating on a different level. So I can use what I see to benefit you, but not be manipulative. I think that to me is just keeping that motto in mind at all times means that you won't use these skills that you gained in some kind of malicious, manipulative way.
I really like that. There's a psychologist that I follow. His name is Dr. Mark Golston, and he talks a lot about how he would interview someone in a situation where he's trying to assess something. And if he wanted to, if he could sense that their body language cues and their tone of voice and all that kind of stuff, he could sense that something was really bothering them and he needed to get them to open up, he would lead into it with the same cues that you're talking about, right? Lower the pitch, slow it down. And he, I'm going to probably botch this, but he says, something's really bothering you right now, isn't it? And then he would just let it sit for as long as humanly possible. And that would coax the person to be able to open up to the point where you could actually start the discussion and have a have a real conversation. I think so often in these kinds of situations, it's very easy to utilize that superpower to try and extract something out of the relationship. And it's very tempting at the same time because you know that you can. I love that you're approaching this with a beneficial mindset of how do I help this person and how do I drive additional value? Now, if you're that person, and you're listening to this right now, and you are worried about being potentially manipulated by someone, are there some cues that you need to, that person needs to watch out for, or things that they need to do in order to protect themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful part of the question. I'm sorry, I didn't answer that when you asked it before. I went off on a different tangent. People often think because like they'll ask me, you know, it's probably so hard to hack you or so like you're probably so good at, I'm a human also. So if you do the things that we're talking about to me, guess what's going to happen? Oxytocin, dopamine, which means I'm going to, I mean, it's impossible. I come into this interview, you say, before we start, you say some wonderful things about my previous work and my present work. You compliment me. You say you're excited to talk to me. How does that not develop rapport, right? You said all these wonderful things about me. For me to not let me develop rapport, I have to be a real jerk. I have to be like, this guy's just a user. And I have to look at you in a bad way, which is going to make this a really horrible conversation. So I first want to start off by saying we're all vulnerable. And I'll tell a story to kind of solidify that. I've sent 14.5 million phishing emails in my life. That's my career. 14.5 million phishing emails. I fell for an actual fish.
I got fished.
Yes. Yeah. Because I'm an Amazon junkie. If Amazon was a drug, I'd be smoking that thing. It's like unbelievable. Okay, that's a terrible reference. But anyhow, like I literally live on Amazon. And especially after COVID, there was like a stream of Amazon trucks with conveyor belts outside my house.
Yeah.
And I got a fish that said one of my orders was going to be declined because of a credit card problem. I tell every client, you open up a browser, you type in Amazon.com, you log in, you check it. What did I do? I clicked the dang link in the email. And the only reason I didn't get caught is because out of habit, I looked at the URL bar and saw it was something, something.ru. But I clicked on a fish. Now, why? That fish had the right emotional trigger at the right time. It was a stressful day. I was super busy. Now, maybe you don't like Amazon. So for you, it wouldn't work. So what I tell people is, first of all, don't look for a way to never be vulnerable. Because the answer to not be vulnerable to this is to be a real a-hole. Right? I mean, it really is. It's to really be a person who just looks at everyone as suspect. So look at everyone as you're only out for yourself, jerk. And I don't want to live my life that way. So here's the way I tell people to stay a little guarded is when someone makes you feel really strong emotion and then makes a request of you. And you can't do this on the moment. You have to have this script running in your brain beforehand. You have to have a commitment to yourself that you're going to think about, is this safe for me before, right? And I'll give you a really horrible example and then a not so. Ted Bundy, a serial killer, was known for using things like, I lost my puppy, or I have crutches. Can you help me? And getting that emotional trigger for women to say, oh, look, he looks so helpless. I want to help him. And he's a good looking guy and he's got a nice face. And trusting that, making a decision that in their mind, they went, I don't know if I should do this. Many, the one who got away, she said, I knew I shouldn't have done it, but she ended up doing it anyway. Why? Because she fell for that emotion. So before you do, say, do I feel safe with this? Does this ring any triggers on me? Don't ignore those.
That's a really good critical question to ask.
Really great critical question. And then a not so critical example is for me, and that fish is when I got that, my training, my previous script was open a browser and do this, but I let emotions get the best of me. So when I got that email and I went, what the heck? One of my orders isn't coming. My internal script should have went, Chris, stop. Wait, hang on. Read that email first. And if I had, it was for George Foreman Grill and Lee Press-On Nails. I've never ordered those two things together. Okay. But I'm saying, like, when I read that, I should have went, that's not my order. But I didn't do it. I just read that first part of the email, got emotional and clicked. So having that script running at all times, it won't save you 100%, but it will make you not the low-hanging fruit. And then Dr. Daniel Goleman, he did research in his book, Emotional Intelligence, on something that he coined as amygdala hijacking. And what he found is that the way to get our amygdala back to normal logic processing is to allow a short period of time in between the emotion and the decision. And that feels bad today, because when we have to wait for a couple nanoseconds,
so
for
instantaneous.
What do you mean it's going to take 10 seconds for this to upload? What the heck is wrong with this computer and a punch and a keyboard? We are so used to immediate gratification that we don't want that time span. So be okay with a short period of time. Like you said, that psychologist that you follow, slow it down a little. It's okay.
Yes. For the listeners who don't understand sort of the amygdala's role in that emotional sort of landscape, could you describe what happens with the brain when you get that emotional response?
Sure. So the amygdalae, there's two of them. They're small walnut-sized pieces of gray matter in the brain. And when we take something in from one of our senses, so see, smell, taste, hear, touch something, that processing goes through the amygdala before it hits the brain. Now, the amygdala's job is to start physiological and psychological sequences before the brain has a chance to catch up. So example, let's say in your history, you're deathly afraid of snakes. You hate snakes. So you're walking through your yard or your garden later on, and out of the corner of your eye, you see what you perceive to be a snake. Your amygdala will create a fear process. So what happens is, you know, your lips get pulled back, your eyes are open, you reel away from it, you gasp. So what is happening? Your eyes open wide to take in all the surroundings. You gasp in air to prepare you for the fight or flight response. The first F is freeze, right? When you tense your muscles, your body releases adrenaline, and that adrenaline creates a moment where you're ready to fight or flight, right? Now, coupled milliseconds later, your eyes, so your visual cortices catch up and it goes, that's the garden hose, silly. And you shake it off and you go back to normal. But your amygdala created this process where you first were ready to do something out of the fear script in your brain. So, and that happens whether it's a snake, it's an email, it's a phone call, it's an in-person, we have those responses. And what Dr. Goleman found, he put an fMRI helmet on his research subjects. And when he tested them, he found that these emotion centers were the ones that were triggered in the limbic system, as opposed to the logic centers in the top part of the brain. So it affects us. We're human. You can't shut it off. I mean, you can. They have surgeries that can shut your amygdala down, but I would not suggest it. Fear is a very useful emotion.
It's very important.
Very important. So I would not suggest an amygdala surgery at all.
Yeah. For me, I think this is a big thing that a lot of people miss in trying to train themselves is they don't realize that a lot of what they're feeling is the body's natural response to stress or fear or whatever it might be. And teaching them how to manage that and control that sort of as a practice becomes probably the most critical part of what I do, because they're used to reacting because of that instantaneous measure that you mentioned before, but that is not ever going to help you in those kinds of, like, there's, well, I shouldn't say not ever. I mean, look, if you're faced with a lion and everything kicks in, you probably should start running, right?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. The lion will probably catch up pretty quick and kill you. But, you know, I mean, you know, it's, the emotions we have, we shouldn't want to learn to get rid of them. We should learn how to still act critically with them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So emotions are like, think about this. When a mother feels intense adrenaline and fear because their child is hurt, they've been known to do superhuman things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They've been known to flip cars off of their kids or stop. I saw a video recently on YouTube of a guy who jumped in a lake after an alligator who was eating his dog and pried the alligator's mouth open to save his dog. Right. I mean, like, that's ridiculous to me. That adrenaline response from him helped him save something he loved. So we don't want to learn to control our emotions by suppressing them. We want to learn how to live effective, empathetic lives while still having human emotion. And altering the way we work, sometimes we think, you know, that we want to alter it the way we work. All I want to do is I want to learn how I could still feel all these things, but not turn into a raging jerk, you know, still help people to improve, help me improve, keep my family safe, and do that all while not shutting down those very important parts of me.
Yeah. Well, I love it, man. Listen, I've had just the most amazing conversation with you. I've learned a ton, and I'm really, really happy that you wrote this book because I feel like it's needed in today's day and age more than ever. I mean, with all the stuff that we've got to deal with. So thank you for writing this book. And if the listeners want to connect with you in some sort of way or get the book, how do they do that?
I got two things, if you'll let me. And thank you for asking me. I appreciate the promotion. So if you go to humanhackingbook.com, on that is all this information. There's also a resources section with all these extra things I built for people who are reading the book that they can download to help them. So humanhackingbook.com. Plus, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, any place that sells books. And I just launched a virtual conference called the Human Hacking Conference, which is not about security. It's about how to do the things we just spoke about. I got Joe Navarro and Mark Bowden and Chase Hughes and Dov Barron and R. Paul Wilson, some amazing people, Robin Dreek coming in, and they're going to do classes for people to learn how to use these skills in their everyday life. So you can connect with me through those sites, through Twitter, LinkedIn, and I'm always available to try to help and communicate with people. I love this stuff. It's my passion. So thank you for having me on and being able to talk about this.
You bet. Well, thank you for being here. For the listeners, just so that you know, we will link out to all of those resources in the show notes. Chris, always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.